You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
Hey, we're going to be talking about writing today and about literature. And with me is someone who's experienced it from different aspects. This is Rand Dugoff, who has many titles, among those being editor of Louisiana Life magazine and Acadiana Profile. She also teaches at Southeastern University, teaches literature, and so has been following the scene. So, hi, Rand.
Good morning.
Got a bunch of questions. Let me start off with this. There was a documentary in which Doug Brinkley, if you feel with him, you know, a historian, he's written many, many books, and he's a good writer. And anyway, he tells a story that a few years ago he was going to a writers' conference, and he told his daughter that, you know, he'd be leaving in a few days, going to a writers' conference somewhere. And she says, "Well, why are you going to a writers' conference?" He says, "Well, because I'm a writer." And he says, "Well, no, you're a historian, you're not a writer, okay?" And then, when you said that, I really related to that, because I've always felt that people don't really accept somebody as being a writer unless they're doing fiction. You know, if you're doing history, they think of you as a historian, okay? But not as much as a writer, even though a good writer has to put in as many skills. In a sense, historical writing is harder than fictional writing, because fictional writer, the world could be anything you want it to be. The characters could be whoever you want them to be, the location, what people say. Whereas with historical writing, you got to get your facts straight and everything, all of that, you know? But I know it's kind of a trick question, but what do you think defines a writer?
I think what defines a writer is someone who writes. And I know that sounds really simplified, but I think that whatever genre you're writing, whether you're published or not published, if you are a writer and you're passionate about doing it, then it doesn't matter. We do this writing marathon as part of the Tennessee Williams Festival, and Richard Luth begins the writing marathon and has everyone turn to each other and say, introduce themselves and say, "I'm a writer." And even people who have never published before, they feel a little bashful about that, and he's like, it doesn't matter if you write, you're a writer. And so I think whether you're writing historical works or whether you're writing a novel, I think as long as you're writing and telling some kind of story, that defines what a writer is.
Well, yeah, but people don't think of somebody as being a writer.
It's true. No,
yeah,
it's true.
Yeah, unless they're doing fiction, right?
Yeah.
Fiction to find. And so
fiction and probably a novel, even at that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. The general population, I think, feels that way. People maybe in the literary community or people who do write probably align more with that. Someone who writes a history book or a novel, they're both writers.
Yeah. There's a wealth of people who've written things in Louisiana that have been published. I think one of the most important people is Stephen Ambrose, who's done some really important books, mostly about war, okay, and mm-hmm. history. I mean, he's an historian. And his Band of Brothers had a big impact on the study of European war. But again, it was like historian Steve Ambrose, right? I mean, it was never, and his books are well written, but it was just never the same thing. And maybe it doesn't make any difference, but other than to acknowledge that that kind of writing requires writing skills also. And
definitely.
Maybe more so. Well, looking from your studies today, what do you see when you look at the South, and especially Louisiana, in terms of the of writing out there?
Oh, wow. It's really an exciting time. I think that the South and New Orleans in particular, people are just doing really amazing things. We've got so many writers coming up in New Orleans, especially right now. And they're really capturing, I think, the culture of the city and the what's going on in the world at large too. So I think it's an exciting time.
Yeah. Now you're associated with the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, as I have been too, and so we both we both connected with that. And I know over times that the topic has been is about the South. Is the South of a source of information and I guess of inspiration? And I think there is something unique about the South in terms of the images that it settles. I mean, going back to the Gothic South and the post-Civil War South, and then the South itself, the swamps and the voodoo and everything else. You don't see that kind of stuff coming out of the Northeast. I mean, you don't see that kind of inspiration.
No, now there's regional writing all across the United States. You know, there was writing out west. A lot of the naturalists wrote about, you know, California, Gold Rush, things like that. And there, you know, the New England writers. So there are regional writers all over, but there's something special about the South. There's a, I don't know, this isn't a very literary word, but there's a vibe about the South. There's that, like you said, that sort of crumbling Gothic sense to it, but there's also just the layers of history, all the different cultures that have been here, and just the landscape that's really unique. Like you said, the bayous and voodoo, there are things that aren't anyplace else in the country. And so I think that that's really what makes the writing in the South so interesting.
But some of the best known writers, i.e. Tennessee Williams or Faulkner, were all from the South.
Yeah.
And they had those images to deal with.
They sure did. I mean, Flannery O'Connor, Eudora Welty, you know, Kate Chopin, she wasn't originally from here, but, you know, she lived here for a time. All those folks, they really just captured it, I think.
So who, you talk about the new emerging people. Who are some of those people?
Oh, wow. Okay, let me think. We've got Alex Jennings. We've got Maurice Carlos Ruffin. We've got Jamila Minnick, who's from Mississippi, but... Jasmine Ward, Anel Lopez. So a lot of the people that are doing events and writing, and we have Jess Armstrong. She was at the festival. She's written a Gothic rompy story that's really fun. So I don't know, more people than I can name probably.
Yeah. You know, there was change about the industry, and It's the back end of the industry. Okay, you got the book, all right, and it's ready to go. And there's things like Amazon. I say it's like a 24-hour global bookstore. And so that's a good thing, all right? And so if you wrote a book about New Orleans and somebody Googles New Orleans and all of a sudden it pops up. On the other hand, there are fewer bookstores, and there are fewer of the independent bookstores. And I noticed recently, I remember when there used to be several bookstores downtown, like off of Canal Street, along Canal Street.
Which ones are you remembering?
What?
Which ones do you remember being downtown?
First of all, the department stores all had a bookstore. Mm-hmm. But what was the one that was on Canal Street? It was a national chain. I want to say Goodfellow, but it's not that. It'll come to me. But there were... Anyway, there were several, okay? Mm-hmm. And none of them are there, all right? And there used to be things where people, if they were in town, you know, tourists, if they wanted to learn more about the city or they got some little spare time, they go into the bookstore and they look. And a tourist downtown really has nowhere to look.
Not a lot.
Other than to go into the internet. There's a couple of independent bookstores.
There are very few in Faulkner. There's Faulkner
Uptown, bookstore. Octavia Bookstore, and the
Garden District.
Yeah, yeah.
Blue Cypress. There's a handful, but like you said, they're not a lot downtown. So for
B. Dalton.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I remember that.
And the and it's just not the same. Okay. And it's almost harder for a writer to be able to break their book. You know. To get out there because there's just not as many outlets. And at the same time, I wonder if people are reading books as much as they used to. I mean, maybe they are, but I don't know because of course the internet absorbs a lot of that time. I mean, you know, are people sitting down and turning on the lamp and reading books as much as they used to?
I don't know if they are or not. I feel like I know as far as being a teacher, I don't feel like the younger people are reading as much. Like my students don't, they say they don't read a lot of books.
Yeah.
I think they're just looking and are used to like short pieces of information coming from social media or whatever electronic source, and that to sit down and read a long novel, they're just not as many are doing it, I think, as used to.
Yeah.
But to go back to the independent bookstores, I think the ones that have remained are doing an amazing job, and they're having the book launches there, and they're having all kinds of events. And I'm so happy to see that some of them have like stayed and that are thriving. It's always going to be a competition with Amazon, but I think that for people who, you know, want to walk into a store and like browse the bookshelves, it's nice that they're still there.
Well, for somebody to break a book, I mean, unless they got national support behind them, I mean, you got to have those kind of events, those kind of signing events. I can tell you from personal experience, I did something at Octavia. Mm-hmm. And Octavia has this meeting room. They've expanded a little bit. It seats about 50 people. And all the seats were filled, and there were a few people standing, so it must have been about 60 people. And so to have that access where you can talk, and then they come and sign books, that's a good thing, all right?
Yeah.
And that's pretty much the way you got to do it. The Jefferson Parish Library has those kind of events where you can go and talk. And that's really the way. You can't just hope for some kind of magic because it's on a shelf at a bookstore that it helps when you're in front of the people and you talk to them and then move on from there.
Yeah, I definitely think that it helps. And then I think that people are using social media in a smart way. I'm not on it a whole lot, but I know that a lot of writers are using that. So between going to the bookstores to launch a book or to do a signing, they're posting things on social media, so they're reaching people that way too. Mm-hmm. It's a challenge, though. I think it's much harder than it used to be, though.
Yeah. I'd ask you what's new out there, but just looking back or within your lifetime, who are some of your favorite writers or books or both?
Well, I am always going to say Eudora Welty because I just love her. And I fell in love with her when I was going to grad school in Southern Mississippi. Dr. Noel Polk was my professor, and we just dove deep into her short stories. So she's always been a love of mine. And I think I'm really drawn to short stories. I love Alice Munro, too. She's not from here, but, you know, I love her writing, too. I don't know. I like Flannery O'Connor. I like a lot of the Southern writers. I teach Southern literature, so I'm always drawn to them, Carson McCullers and people like that.
There was a professor who comes to the Tennessee William Festival near every year. He wasn't here this past year, but he used to edit the Tennessee Williams Journal. I think he was at Middle Tennessee State University, whatever it is. So anyway, in that capacity, he got to meet different people in the literary field. And he told a story from Gore Vidal. At some point, he had an interview with Gore Vidal. And Gore Vidal told this story that one time he went to visit Tennessee Williams, and maybe it was like a year or so after Streetcar came out, all right? And he went in and he sat down, and Tennessee sitting behind a typewriter. And he says, "What are you working on, Tennessee?" He says, "Well, I'm working on Streetcar." And by that time, Streetcar had like, it had been a play, it had won a Pulitzer Prize, it was going to be a movie and all this. And he says, "How are you working on Streetcar?" And he says, "I just didn't think I got the ending right." Okay. And so to the very end, he was working on the ending. You know, sometimes you start off thinking about the ending first and then working back to it.
Mm-hmm.
And while we're on another Tennessee Williams story, they spent a lot of time in Key West. That was one of his favorite places. Key West and New Orleans and New York were his favorite places. And he'd stay at an apartment building. I guess it's kind of a bed and breakfast sort of thing. Well, anyway, he's leaving one day, and he goes and asks for the bill. And the guy gives him the bill, and Tennessee said, "Well, look, I don't have the cash." He says, "Can I just give you a check?" And the guy said, "Well, we don't usually take checks, but okay, I'll take a check." And so he gives him a check. And he knew that there's no way somebody with a check signed by Tennessee Williams would cash it, all right? Okay. All right. And that, and he didn't. It was never, I mean, they may have even framed it. And
that's great.
This guy I was talking to said it used to be kind of a common thing that a lot of people with some element of celebrity to them, okay, would say, and this is before visas and all that, but that, you know, that popular. So they have cash, they have a check, and then the check, and so essentially they wound up getting a free thing. So
sneaky, huh?
Yeah. What do you teach? What do you hear from the students? I mean, what are they interested in? Where do they want to go?
What do you mean, go?
In terms of, do they want to write? I mean, is there any area that excites them, or do they just want to learn more about it?
Yeah, we've got a lot of students that are interested in writing. They're doing really innovative things. Students are interested in writing graphic novels or doing fantasy. They are taking it in lots of different directions.
Mm-hmm. You know, something funny though about a lot of people who are interested in writing, that they come across a lot of people say, "Man, I'd love to do a column." All right,
mm-hmm.
And so okay, well, everybody has at least one column in them. Okay, write about it. Okay. When you get to number two, you got to think a little bit harder, okay? And like when you're like number four or five, right, they're really stuck.
When you're on number 50, though.
Yeah. And sometimes their column career, but that's part of it, you know, being able to generate the topics and to keep it moving and to keep it fresh. It's not as easy as people think.
It is part of it. And you're right. I think people think it's a great idea. They know about a topic and they think they could write a lot of columns on it, but after a few, it's difficult to keep it fresh and think of like different angles. But I feel like it's like a long game, and if somebody commits to doing it and they can just ride out sort of the parts that are difficult to come up with topics, it can take them in a whole different direction. It'd be interesting.
Yeah. Do you have a book in you that you want to write one day?
I've written a couple of novels, manuscripts, and I'm trying to get an agent. So yeah, I've written like a literary fiction story about family, and I've tried a murder mystery just for fun. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've published some short stories. I like writing short stories, and I've done some of that. But the next step is finding a literary agent, working on that part.
Yeah.
That's a challenge. The whole publishing industry is really different and different than it used to be.
Yeah. And well, you probably know this better than I do. I'm under the impression that there's more regional publishers who do good stuff. I mean, LSU Press has really done some good. Now, they're mostly nonfiction, but they're really doing some good books. And the university presses in particular.
There's a lot of independent presses, too, like small presses that have really come up. There's like Unnamed Press, which is, I think, out west, that's really doing some great things. So, yeah, there's independent presses. There's academic presses. There's regional presses. So I feel like because the publishing industry has been on lock for so long and people have had such a hard time breaking through, that these other options, like the smaller publishers, are a route for people to go. And they're kind of growing as a result because people are tired of trying to go through the big five publishers. It's just like a wall they can't get over. And so, yeah, that's kind of exciting to see all these independent and academic presses doing.
And one thing I want to acknowledge is Pelican Publishing.
Yeah.
Which is has always been a steady publishing house, but in the last couple of years, it has, I don't know if it's a merger with what the proper thing is, but Arcadia Press out of Charleston. And Arcadia just adds like a whole another level, I mean, in terms of what they can do, in terms of the editing and the quality of production. I mean, the public is doing a good job.
Yeah.
And so they have a local publisher merged with essentially a national publisher. It's a good thing.
It's
so
a great thing.
They have the capacities to do things. I mean, I have personal experiences, but also a volume, the City Park book that Bob Becker done. And again, that's mostly pictorial and short narrations and all that, but they did a beautiful job with it. And so to have that kind of thing that's done. So
that's great.
So good for the publishers.
Mm-hmm.
What your experiences with Louisiana Life and Acadia Profile, what do you feel? What do you feel about Louisiana and the Cajun country as its topic areas?
Well, I love it. I've lived here my whole life, and I'm real excited to be able to work with writers who talk about topics in these areas. I have family in Brobridge, so we used to go up to Brobridge several times a year, all the time I was growing up, and just go hang out there and go to little day trips and neighborhoods around there. So I love that country. It's beautiful. I love the people. So it's been really fun to be able to work on two magazines that focus on the world that I live in and grew up in. And I'm learning so many things because I don't know a lot of what's going on in northern Louisiana, for instance. I don't travel up there very much. And so it's been a great learning experience for me, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a complex state, right? I mean, it's most best known for the southern part of the state. Louisiana below I-10 is where most of the people live and everything else. But the whole different set of stories in North Louisiana and Shreveport and Monroe, and it's a different culture too.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an interesting state, and you know, this was a political thing too, that the state for a long time was pretty much divided. I mean, the North and the South just kind of like in two different directions. It would help unite the state a little bit more was the interstates,
mm-hmm.
because it became easier to go okay. Like all the highways ran east and west, and so if you want to go to New Orleans or Shreveport, I mean, you get there, but you got to take different highways and all that. Okay, once like I-49 was established, okay, you take I-10 to Lafayette, you turn on I-49, and so it's quicker to get to Shreveport and it's quicker to get there, and so I think the interstates have had their impact to a certain case. So, And then with Acadian profile, that's a whole different set of possibilities too out there and all that, and things to cover. Certainly visually, okay, with country and like Lake Martin and all the birds and everything.
Visually, the music is different. The food is different. Like you said, it really is a unique region that just it is visually really amazing.
You know, I'll pass this on to you because I've gone frequently to the conference of the international and regional magazines, and one thing that I just talk about what people really want to see high demand for is lighthouses. Okay, so whenever there's an issue with lighthouses on it,
mm-hmm.
it does really really well.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know something about a lighthouse, I was even looking into it one time, and there are some lighthouses in Louisiana. Okay. But I mean, maybe not as much as in Maine or anything like that. But you know, but there were lighthouses, and like if somebody did an article, it would be obviously more of a pictorial thing.
I wonder what draws people to the lighthouses so much. I wonder what draws people to them so much. I mean, they're beautiful to look at, like seeing them. But
I think is it like a symbol of hope, a symbol of rescue? Anyway. This notion of this light late at night is something that people kind of relate to.
Yeah, you know? There's something romantic about it, too, I think.
There's a lot of songs, country songs, that refer to the midnight train.
Mm-hmm.
All right? You know, Hank Williams does it, and I'm supposed to cry. And then Johnny Cash, and you know, I hear the train coming, it's coming down the tracks,
yep.
and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that light, it's a light at night, okay? And I guess it's a symbol of hope or something.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, I could see that.
It's intriguing topic. Is there any sort of like quirky rule for riding that you have for yourself? Or
the rule for riding that I have and that I have for me and that I have for students is that when you're drafting, don't stop.
I'm sorry, when you what?
When you're drafting, don't stop.
Uh-huh.
Sort of push yourself. Like a lot of times I'll look over my writing and think about it and want to change something, and it just slows the momentum. And so I tell myself and I tell my students, like, do some pre-writing beforehand and do your revising after. Don't do it when you're trying to get the words on the page. Uh-huh. Just try to get the words on the page, even if they're messy, even if you've got, you know, scratch outs or whatever. And so that's my rule, is that when you're drafting, just do a run of it. Like, sit down for whatever, a half hour, 40 minutes, and go. And don't, like, critique it, and don't, like, spell check something, and don't look something up. Just go. Mm-hmm. So that's, for me, I don't know if that's a quirky rule, but that's a thing that I mm-hmm. do.
You know, corollary to this, not exactly what you talk about, but it just brings it to mind, is when you're writing on the computer and, like, you almost finish, and for some reason you push the wrong button or something and you lose the article.
Oh, that's terrible. Okay.
And that
has that happened to you?
Yeah. It doesn't happen as much as it used to. I mean, with the earlier computers, it used to do okay. But you just lose the article. And so you kind of spend time trying to find it, and you can't find it, and then you you're cursing and you're feeling bad about yourself. And I've realized once that happens, the thing to do is right away start writing it again.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, while it's still fresh in your mind, you know, if you just get mad, go out, get something to drink, and get in a rage and all that kind of stuff. First of all, it's going to just be hanging over you.
Yeah.
Okay. But once you can sit down and say, okay, let's go.
It's still
ahead
floating
and do
around
it
in your head a little bit. So if you do it right after, a lot of it's going to come back out.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe when you do it, sometimes you think, well, you know, maybe I could say it's a little bit better. That's another thing. So
there's some writing craft book, and I can't think of the name of it off the top of my head, but this writer suggests writing your whole novel, then putting it away, and then writing the whole novel again without really looking back at it.
Uh-huh.
I've never tried it before, but just the idea of the things that are in your head and you've already gotten them down, that they come out in a way that's sometimes better than it was the first time. So I wonder if, like you said, when you lose something and you sit down and you write it, if it is better.
Yeah.
Maybe it is.
Well, it sounds a little bit...
It doesn't feel like it, though.
Yeah. No. Well, once you get going, I mean, you know, once you realize you got your groove back on this and you can do it. Because when you rewrite, it doesn't take as long as the first time because all the thoughts are together.
Now, do you write with pen or on the computer?
Oh, I couldn't write a pen. Oh, I couldn't write with pen anymore.
No, me either.
I can barely hold a pen anymore. Okay.
I can't think unless I'm typing. The words
don't come out
unless I'm typing.
Like, I love fountain pens.
Me too.
And I have a collection of fountain pens. But I don't write with them anymore because it's like writing is something that's lost, okay, anymore, okay, so.
I do feel like when I write with a pen, the writing, the words are more beautiful. Like, it's like I can spend more time. I think it's the shaping of the words. But just as far as if you're writing a long work, it would take forever. I have a friend named Marley Stewart, and he writes all his novels. He writes by hand, and he's just got these big, thick books of handwritten works, and I can't do it.
Yeah, no. Look, I couldn't write a. I don't know if I could write a full sentence with a pen. I mean, like short, cryptic notes or something. You can do and all of that, you know. And it's just, it's just a muscle of the of loss. So
I do like to print sometimes and revise with a pen.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, just like circling things and scratching things out. That's easier to me than drafting with a pen.
You know, a quirky rule I have. And there's nothing wrong with this. Okay, there's nothing wrong with not doing this. I'm not sure if I've ever told this to anybody. I never start a paragraph with the word "the."
Really? Interesting.
Really?
Why?
Just because a long time ago I decided I didn't want to. It just seemed too easy.
Yeah.
To do that. And so it kind of made you think a little bit. Right, okay.
I do have a quirky rule as a teacher. I don't let my students start sentences with "this" or "it."
With it or?
This or it.
Yeah.
I just don't. It leads to passive voice, and it's just like lazy and vague. Like, what is this? What is it?
But when you do that, it makes you think a little bit more.
Well, and then when they fix it, like if they do it and I'll circle it, it's so much better when they fix it. It's like not starting a sentence with "the." Like, it's better probably not starting a sentence with "the."
Every so often, I'll see something that I wrote, and there's a paragraph that starts with "they," and I go, "What? Where did that come from?" And it was like some editor, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like, maybe it needs to be the word "they," okay? But no, if ever you say the word "they" on one of my things, leaving a paragraph, I didn't do it, okay? It was just like that. But those are interesting rules, okay?
Yeah.
And then, I'm big on endings, okay?
Endings of sentences or of
endings
the piece?
Endings of with the piece, yeah. And sometimes, and also at beginnings, obviously, but the ending is really the most important. And sometimes, even before I get into something, the first thing I ask, so what's the ending going to be and what's the beginning going to be?
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then once you establish that, then you can say, well, you know, maybe
find
I can
your
do,
way there.
Maybe I can do this. So.
Yeah. Yeah, endings are really important.
Yeah. Well, it's your last impression.
I think they're tricky, too, because I think sometimes people run out of steam by the end, and so they're not as, significant as they should be.
Yeah. So it gets back to Tennessee Williams thinking years later, I don't know if I got that ending right, you know, so.
Mm-hmm.
They keep going. Well, anyway. Well, thanks for all that you do. You're in the middle of with a career that offers a lot of fascinating opportunities, you know. It's fun to be able to deal with words and language and everything else.
I love it. I feel really lucky. I just, in this literary world, I have a podcast, too, and we talk to authors about their books, and I just have surrounded myself with books and writers, and it makes me real happy.
Okay.
I feel lucky.
And if anybody once access to Louisiana Life or KDNN Profile, they're go to the web, okay, and look them up. Kelly, what should they look up for those magazines?
If you go to LouisianaLife.com or KDNAProfile.com, they can find all the information they need.
Okay. So.
Great. Thank you so much.
Randy, I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.